Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Samuel chapter 20. I'm going to do verses 1 through 26, the entire chapter. And this chapter concerns Sheba's rebellion, his rebellion against David. Our context is this. In our last chapter, chapter 19, we see David meeting at Gilgal as the tribe of Judah brings him back and says, "Be our king, David, let bygones be bygones as we try to recover from this horrible civil war with your son Absalom." Also, the northern 10 tribes had decided to throw in their lot with David, and they said, "We're with you, David, and everything is all peace and harmony and love and kisses," and all of a sudden another rebellion breaks out. All this reconciliation happened right before David crossed the Jordan, going back west toward Jerusalem. And also after he crossed the Jordan and was at Gilgal, right across the Jordan River. And that was our context from the last chapter. So we start now in 2 Samuel 20, verses 1 and 2. "Now a worthless fellow happened to be there," that's at Gilgal, "whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. And he blew the trumpet and said, 'We have no portion in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel.' So all the men of Israel withdrew from following David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah remained steadfast to their king from the Jordan even to Jerusalem." And of course, from Jordan to Jerusalem, that's the area of Jordan, the southern tribe of Judah. They remained loyal. Now this Sheba that rebelled here, he perhaps had been in Absalom's rebellion. This is the first time we hear of him. He was a Benjamite, and of course, Benjamites are likely to be disaffected because they were the tribesmen, fellow tribesmen of King Saul, and King Saul hated David, and they had a civil war, and David went to a lot of trouble trying to unite the tribe of Judah with the tribe of Benjamin, Benjamin representing all the northern 10 tribes. Well, you can still see the discontent here. You can still see the political divides between the south and the north, between Judah and Benjamin. Remember Shimei, the guy who threw rocks at David and cursed David when David was at Bahurim at the top on the eastern side of the top of Mount of Olives, the Mount of Olives. He was a Benjamite. So David had political problems with the Benjamites. And this Sheba says, "We have no portion in David." That's ironic since the Israelites, the northern 10 tribes, just said they owned 10 twelfths of David in the last chapter, 2 Samuel 19, verse 43. "But the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, 'We have 10 parts in the king. Therefore, we also have more claim on David than you.'" So Sheba was not entirely accurate when he said, "We have no portion in David." What he means is, we rebels, we rebellious Benjamites and Israelites of the northern 10 tribes, we have no portion in David. But some of them had already gone over to David in the last chapter at Gilgal. Now Sheba continues and he says, "Nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse." Why did he mention the son of Jesse? Perhaps to emphasize David's lowly birth, because Jesse was a mere shepherd. He didn't mention the fact that David was the king of Israel, the former king of all of Israel, and now the king of Judah. He didn't mention that. And then Sheba says, "Every man to his tents, O Israel." Why go to their tents, back to their homes? Well, to withdraw from Gilgal, going back to your tents, that's obviously looking like a rebellion. So it was a call to withdraw from David. It was a call to consider who should be the king of the northern tribes, perhaps, as they go back north and contemplate another political assembly. Perhaps it was a call to a military rebellion. Jameson Fawcett Brown says, in fact, it was probably a call to a military rebellion. "To your tents," Jameson Fawcett Brown is, quote, "the usual watchword of national insurrection, and from the actual temper of the people, it was followed by effects beyond what he probably anticipated." In other words, Jameson Fawcett and Brown think that Sheba wasn't really planning to start a military revolt, but was planning a political revolt, and then things got out of hand. Well, that's speculation. I don't know. And so in verse 2, "the men of Judah remained steadfast from the Jordan even to Jerusalem." What that probably means is that the men of Judah alone escorted David from Gilgal to Jerusalem. The Jordan, Gilgal is close to the Jordan, so from Jordan to Jerusalem is the march that David took back to Jerusalem. The Holman Christian Study Bible makes that a little bit clearer than the NASB. It says the people of Judah remained loyal to their king on his way from the Jordan River to Jerusalem. "On his way" is in brackets. It's not in the original text, but the Holman Christian Study Bible says that's what's being referred to here. So David goes back to Jerusalem, but he doesn't have the northern 10 tribes with him. back to where he was at when he ruled Judah from Hebron before the kingdom merged. He was down there for 7 years after Saul had been killed, and so it took him 7 years to merge the kingdom, and so now he's right back where he started from. 2 Samuel 20, verse 3. Then David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, the concubines whom he had left to keep the house, and placed them under guard and provided them with sustenance, but he did not go into them. So they were shut up until the day of their death, living as widows. Now, if you recall, David left 10 concubines to take care of the palace while he left, and Absalom, at the behest of Ahithophel, the treacherous advisor, former advisor of David, the new advisor of Absalom, the rebel, Ahithophel said, Absalom, why don't you go up there, put those concubines on the roof of David's palace, have sex with them, and show everybody who's the king now. That was the way they did that back then. You took up somebody's concubines. That means power had been shifted to you. So these women had been defiled by Absalom. And so David puts them under the guard. He did not go into them. That means, as the Holman Christian Study Bible has it, David no longer slept with them. Now, why did David do that? John Gill gives some suggestions. Here's the first one. This was a punishment for easily yielding to the lust of Absalom. Oh, come on, please. That's ridiculous. What choice did the concubines have? As Adam Clark points out, David could not punish those concubines as they were not in the transgression. They didn't do anything wrong. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say the concubines were not divorced, for they were guiltless. In other words, David did divorce them because they hadn't done anything wrong. They were violated. All right, so that's not why David put them under guard. Here's the second possible reason, again suggested by John Gill. David wanted to hide them from public view so they would not remind people of David's sin. Now, that's not a bad speculation by John Gill, in my view. Here's Adam Clark's speculation. David wanted to keep the concubines from marrying other men because these other men might have been dangerous to the state. A pretender to the throne can say, hey, I've got David's wife in my bed, so I'm a big shot, so why don't you follow me? That makes sense, too. Although I must say, it seems that no other man would want to marry a defiled concubine unless it was to say, hey, my wife used to be the wife of David the king. Here's a fourth reason. This is my speculation. Maybe David just doesn't want to have happen again what happened before. Some pretender come up there and shack up with his concubines like Absalom did. But for whatever reason, David shut him up under guard. Now, as I said, David didn't sleep with the concubines because they were considered defiled because of Absalom's incest with them. Not only did Absalom have sex with these concubines, it was incestuous sex because they were his father's concubines. 2 Samuel 16:22, so they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, and Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel, where everybody could see it. Well, they could see him going in and coming out, and I guess they figured out what was going on inside the tent. Now, not having sex with defiled concubines was consistent with the social practices of the time, says the NIV Study Bible. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, quote, nor was their confinement to a sequestered life a very heavy doom in a region where women have never been accustomed to go much abroad. And not to mention that, they were well fed and protected by the king, so it wasn't the end of the world for the concubines. We go now to 2 Samuel 20, verses 4 through 5. Then the king said to Amasa, call out the men of Judah for me within 3 days, and be present here yourself. So Amasa went to call out the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which he had appointed, which David had appointed Amasa. Now, David had just replaced Joab with Joab's cousin Amasa for political reasons. We see that in 2 Samuel 19:13, the last chapter. David is negotiating with the Judahites for David to be invited back into the Judahites' good graces, and David says to the men of Judah, say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? Amasa was David's sister Abigail's son. Are you not my bone and my flesh? May God do so to me and more also. Typical oath. If you will not be commander of the army before me continually in place of Joab. So Amasa was replaced, or Joab was replaced by Amasa, and that's going to make Joab mad, and that's going to have consequences, which we're going to see in just a minute. But anyway, Amasa, that's why Amasa's in charge now and not Joab. His first job, his first military assignment by David was to muster the people within 3 days to take care of Sheba's rebellion, and Amasa fails to do it. Now, here are several reasons why, four reasons possibly to explain why Amasa delayed. First possible reason, he was just negligent. He didn't get the job done. Second possible reason, he was secretly in cahoots with Sheba and his rebels. I mean, after all, Amasa was Absalom's former general, and Absalom rebelled. Maybe Sheba wants to rebel too, and maybe Amasa is not really that loyal to David, even though he's now in charge of David's military. I don't think so. I don't think Amasa was in cahoots with Sheba, but it is a possibility as to why he was late in that 3-day assignment. Third possible reason, he was unwilling, or the tribe of Judah was unwilling to serve under Amasa, because Amasa was Absalom's general, and Amasa tries to gather the troops together, and the troops say, I don't think so. I don't think we want to go with you, Amasa. So Amasa's got to spend some time politicking and smoothing ruffled feathers and so forth. Or maybe David didn't give Amasa enough time to do the job. I don't know the military situation well enough to know whether that was enough time or not. But for whatever reason, Amasa didn't get the job done. And so we go now to verse 6, and we see this. And David said to Abishai, Now Sheba the son of Bichri will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your lord's servants and pursue him, so that he does not find for himself fortified cities and escape from our sight. So David apparently got tired of waiting on Amasa, so he gets Joab's brother Abishai and says, go chase down Sheba. Now, of course, he could have gotten Joab, but I think he's still pretty much ticked at Joab. Joab really reamed him out when David was crying too much over Absalom. Joab had killed Abner right when David was about to make a political rapprochement with the northern 10 tribes, and Abner was the northern Benjamite's general, and Abner killed him in a matter of private revenge. So David didn't like Joab, so he goes to Abishai, I speculate. Now, this appointment of Abishai probably galled Joab. Joab had already lost his appointment to Amasa, and now he's just a secondary military commander. Verse 6 says, David says to Abishai, take your lord's servants. Abishai's lord was David, so take David's servants, and he means his men. So that's the NASB translation, just to show you what terrible translation that Bible usually comes up with compared to the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. Take my men and pursue him. You can actually understand it. 2 Samuel 20, verse 7. So Joab's men went out after him. Now, we switch from Abishai to Joab. Now, in verse 7, Joab's men went after him, along with the Cherethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men, and they went out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba the son of Bichri. Now, we're assuming that Joab is now in a division of the army, a subordinate military unit of the army, because Abishai is in charge of the whole thing, but the story now shifts to Joab as he's going out to chase Sheba. And along with Joab went the Cherethites and the Pelethites. These Cherethites and Pelethites show up all the time in descriptions of David's kingdom, and I just love how people speculate about who they are. I'm going to read you 8 speculations. I report, you decide. They could be the king's bodyguards. Number 1. Number 2, they could be 2 prominent families in Israel. Number 3, they could be 2 factions in the Sanhedrin, the ruling council, the ruling body of Israel. Number 4, they could be archers and slingers, Adam Clark suggests. Number 5, they could be 2 different nationalities, the Cherethites being Philistines and the Pelethites being from Pelet, wherever that is. Number 6, some say the Cherethites were those who accompanied David as he fled from Saul, and the Pelethites were those who came to David at Ziklag. Number 7, Cherethites were executioners, Pelethites were couriers. That's Easton's dictionary suggestion. Number 8, Easton's also speculates that, actually this is Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, speculate that the Cherethites and Pelethites were 2 Philistine tribes from which David chose his bodyguard. And Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown also say that Cherethites might mean Cretans. Who knows? Who cares? Also, the mighty men, as the NASB puts it, went out with Joab. These were military leaders of some description. We proceed now to 2 Samuel 20, verses 8 through 10. When they, that's Abishai and Joab's men, were at the large rock in Gibeon, Amasa met them there. Joab wore a military uniform, and strapped over it at his hip was a sword and a scabbard. As he, that's Joab, stepped forward, the sword dropped. How are you, my brother? Joab asked Amasa. He, Joab, took hold of Amasa's beard with his right hand to kiss him. Amasa wasn't on his guard against the sword in Joab's left hand. Joab stabbed him in the stomach, and his intestines poured out on the ground. He died without being stabbed again. Then Joab and his brother Abishai pursued Sheba, son of Bichri. Now, at this large rock in Gibeon, that rock is unknown. Gibeon is the well-known city to the northwest of Jerusalem. If you look at Jerusalem and you go 3 miles or so to the north on the main road there, you're at Gibeah. Consider Gibeah, that's Saul's hometown where he was born, where he had his kingdom, his capital city. Consider Gibeah as the point of an isosceles triangle turned upside down, and then you go northeast on the short edge of that isosceles triangle and you hit Geba. That's where Joshua, a couple centuries earlier, had big battles up there near Ai, right south of Ai. And then if you go back to Gibeah and go northwest from that point, about maybe 4 miles or so, you hit Gibeon. So Gibeon, Geba, and Gibeah. Real easy to confuse them, so I look at it as the 3G triangle. Gibeon actually is mentioned a lot in Israelite history. But anyway, there was a big rock there, and that's where they met. Joab was already there. Amasa, being late, he shows up there with him, apparently to join troops, to join forces with him. Amasa, of course, is not suspecting any treachery. Joab had a sword strapped around him in a scabbard. He stepped forward. The sword dropped. This, of course, was probably done on purpose by Joab. So Joab stoops down to scoop up the sword with his left hand, and then he takes his right hand to grab a hold of Amasa's beard to kiss him. That sounds a little weird to us, but that's what they did back then. They would grab a beard and kiss the beard. So Amasa's thinking, here's a friendly greeting from my first cousin, actually he was, my fellow general in David's army. He wasn't on his guard. He didn't see that Joab's left hand had wrapped itself around that sword that was on the ground, picked it up, and stabbed him in the stomach. Amasa probably assumed Joab was just going to pick the sword up and put it back in its scabbard, in its sheath. And plus, most of the time, people are on guard against a right-handed person stabbing you with their right hand. And Joab's right hand was kissing Amasa's beard in a friendly fashion, holding the beard. And so Amasa had no reason to suspect this treachery. And plus, it was his first cousin, for crying out loud. Now, the next question is why did Joab kill Amasa? Well, perhaps Joab wanted his army command back, and he figured this is the way to get it. Perhaps Joab suspected that Amasa was going to rebel against David. After all, Amasa had just recently been fighting for Absalom against David, and Amasa was late in meeting that 3-day deadline that David had given him to muster the troops to fight Sheba. Maybe Joab is thinking Amasa is spending those 3 days trying to create an insurrection, trying to gather troops to overthrow David. And that's possible. So it was either selfish reasons, he wanted his army command back, or it was reasons of state, I want to protect David. Well, I've got such a negative attitude toward Joab, I suspect it was personal reasons, he wanted his army command back. John Gill points out that even though Amasa had been promoted by David, he was now punished in the providence of God for having participated in Absalom's rebellion. We go now to 2 Samuel 20, verses 11 through 13. Now there stood by Amasa, the dead Amasa, or the wallowing in his blood Amasa. Now there stood by him one of Joab's young men and said, whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow David. Now let's stop here. Probably what happened was as Amasa's lying there, Joab needs to explain there's been a change in command. And of course he's dealing with soldiers, and soldiers are not really going to really appreciate that their commander has been assassinated. So he probably put a young man there to say, look, make your choice here. Amasa's dead. Joab's alive. You going to stick with David? Follow Joab? What other choice do you have? That was the plan. Verse 12, but Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the middle of the highway. Well, I said maybe he was still alive. I don't think so, because wallowing in your blood, a lot of times you think the person's still alive. But here it said that in verse 10, it says that Amasa died without being stabbed again. He was stabbed once and that was it. So I assume he was dead there, but he presented a pretty hideous appearance to the soldiers who were using that road to go chase Sheba. We continue with verse 12. And when the man saw that all the people stood still, that's the man standing by Amasa's corpse, and all the people, that means all the soldiers stood still and stopped and looked at the corpse, they wouldn't keep walking. They were grossed out, shocked by what they had seen. So this man removed Amasa from the highway into the field and threw a garment over him when he saw that everyone who came by him stood still. As soon as he, Amasa, was removed from the highway, all the men, all the soldiers, passed on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. Now notice this man standing by Amasa's corpse said this to the people passing by, to the soldiers passing by, whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David. Who's mentioned first? Joab or David? Joab. Not David, Joab. Because Joab's the real power in the kingdom. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that here the conjunction of these two names is very significant. It shows that one could not afford to do without the other. Neither Joab to rebel against David, nor David to get rid of Joab, though hating him. So Joab and David probably hated each other, but they needed each other. Kind of like a marriage of convenience. Now I detect here a hint that when this man standing by the corpse of Amasa, he's saying, whoever favors Joab, follow him. Whoever follows David, go for David. He's hinting that Amasa has committed some kind of disloyalty. In other words, following Joab is going to be following David. And by implication, this dead body down here didn't want to follow David. I can't prove that, but I just suspect it. So the body of Amasa is put into the field to keep the soldiers from stopping and looking at it. In fact, the rest of the soldiers that passed on after Joab to chase Sheba, they probably didn't even know that there had been a change of command. They probably didn't even know that Amasa had been killed. So the original idea of putting a man by Amasa's corpse and explaining what happened and asking for loyalty, that didn't work so well because people didn't say they were for Joab or for David. They just stood there in shock. The soldiers did. So, plan B, take the body and hide it so we won't have to deal with this anymore. We go now to verse 14, 2 Samuel 20. Sheba passed through all the tribes of Israel to Abel of Beth-Makkah. All the Berites came together and followed him. Now, Abel of Beth-Makkah, if you look at the map, which I'm doing now, you go to the Sea of Galilee, you go up the Jordan River to little Lake Hula, you go keep going up the Jordan River till you get to the city of Dan, which is a little bit to the east of the Jordan River there. You get up to the very northern end of Israel, the tribe of Naphtali. Abel Beth Maka is right at the opening of the Coil of Syria, the land between the Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon ranges. It's basically about, 10 miles or so from the southern tip of Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon being the southernmost extremity of the Anti-Lebanon range. So it's very far north, in other words. So what Sheba has done, he's gone through all of Israel trying to pick up supporters as he goes, as he passes through all of northern Israel. That's why it says in verse 14, Sheba passed through all the tribes of Israel. He's picking up support. All the Berites came together. Those are the people from Beeroth, which is a city in Benjamin. And of course, Sheba was a Benjamite. So they came together and followed Sheba. We go now to 2 Samuel 20, verses 15 through 17. Joab's troops came and besieged Sheba in Abel of Beth-Makkah. I didn't tell you anything about Abel of Beth-Makkah. It's kind of an interesting place. This is from Easton's Dictionary. The word Abel Beth-Makkah means meadow of the house of Makkah. It's a city in the north of Palestine in the neighborhood of Dan. That's the city of Dan I just mentioned, in the tribe of Naphtali. It was a place of considerable strength and importance. It is called a mother in Israel, as we'll see in just a couple of verses. It was besieged by Joab. That's what we're talking about here. Also by Ben-Hadad of Syria in 1 Kings 15 and Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria in 2 Kings 15. So it's sort of it's not a minor place. It's not a little hamlet. It is elsewhere called Abel Maim, Meadow of the Waters, 2 Chronicles 16. We go now to 2 Samuel 20, verses 15 through 17. Joab's troops came and besieged Sheba and Abel of Beth-Makkah. They built an assault ramp against the outer wall of the city. While all the troops with Joab were battering the wall to make it collapse, a wise woman called out from the city, "Listen, listen, please tell Joab to come here and let me speak with him." When he, Joab, came near her, the woman asked, "Are you Joab?" "I am," he replied. "Listen to the words of your servant," she said to him. He answered, "I'm listening." Now this ramp that Joab's troops brought up against the wall of Abel of Beth-Makkah, some say it's a siege engine, not a ramp, but a ramp is very close to being a siege engine. It's just a ramp is a particular type of siege engine. Doesn't matter. They were working on knocking the city down. And, of course, you take a city, you slaughter everybody in the city unless they surrender. So it's a serious business for the people of Abel Beth Maacah. All the troops with Joab were battering the wall. John Gill says perhaps they were using stones to batter the wall. Maybe they were using battering rams. I don't know how ancient warfare worked back then. But at any rate, a wise woman called out from the city. Now this is interesting, a wise woman. Joab had earlier used a wise woman to help him, the wise woman of Tekoa. You might have remembered that in a few chapters back, 2 Samuel 14, verse 2. So Joab sent to Tekoa and brought a wise woman from there and said to her, "Please pretend to be a mourner and put on mourning garments now and do not anoint yourself with oil, but be like a woman who has been mourning for the dead many days." And then this wise woman goes to David and gives him a cock and bull story about how one of her sons had killed the other son. And now the kinsman avenger is going to kill the murderer, and then she's not going to have any sons left. And the point was, David, yeah, one of your sons killed another son. Absalom killed Amnon, but if you don't take care here, Absalom's going to lose his inheritance, and you need to look out for him. Joab wanted reconciliation between David and Absalom, so Joab is used to wise women. He's not going to be too proud. She's just a woman. I'm not going to listen to her. No, he listened to her. In fact, the wise woman of Tekoa and this wise woman of Abel Beth Maacah, these two women show that women's counsels would indeed and could be heeded in that patriarchal times and those patriarchal societies. Wisdom comes to the top like cream. Jameson Fossick Brown suggests this wise woman was a judge or governess of the place. I don't know about that. I'm not sure how many times in a patriarchal ancient society you're going to have a woman leading the place, but at any rate, she was smart. And we see her terms here in 2 Samuel 20, verses 18 through 19. She said, "In the past, they used to say, 'Seek counsel in Abel,'" that is, Abel Beth Maacah, "and that's how they settled disputes." In other words, it's the Geneva of the ancient world, or the New York City where the United Nations is. People talk together and settle disputes, allegedly. Verse 19, she says, "I am a peaceful person, one of the faithful in Israel. But you're trying to destroy a city that is like a mother in Israel. Why would you devour the Lord's inheritance?" All right, so Abel was known for his skill in arbitration, but the King James margin has a different translation and possibility. The meaning of that, I don't have the translation here, but Jameson Fossick Brown takes the meaning of the margin to mean this: "When the people see you lay siege to Abel, they said, 'Surely he will ask if we will have peace.'" Now, what that would be referring to is the law. The law prescribes an offer of peace to a besieged city. It has to be made. Deuteronomy 20:10, "When you approach a city to fight against it, you shall offer it terms of peace." And so, if you translate it as the KJV margin, "When the people see you lay siege to Abel, they will say, 'Surely Joab is going to ask if we will have peace.'" In other words, he's going to give us terms. And that, by the way, was the typical policy, even all through the Middle Ages and Western history. Terms are always offered to a besieged city because people didn't like to besiege cities. It was long and costly. Much easier to have them surrender. Well, if the margin is correct here in the KJV, this wise woman is asking Joab to follow the law and to spare the city, but I don't think it's the margin. I think what she's just saying, we're well known for settling disputes, and here's my way of settling this dispute with you, Joab. And she says, first of all, "I'm peaceful. I'm not interested in war. I'm one of the faithful in Israel." And she's implying there that Abel Beth Maacah was not involved in Absalom's rebellion. She had always remained loyal to David. And she's saying, "Hey, Joab, it's going to be absurd for you to punish a city that has been so loyal to David. Why are you trying to destroy it? Why devour the Lord's inheritance? This city is Yahweh's inheritance, an inheritance from Yahweh. Now, this city is also a mother in Israel. And a mother in Israel would be a metropolitan city which had several towns and villages under its jurisdiction, as John Gill points out. We go now to 2 Samuel 20, verses 20 through 22. Joab replied, far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. Such is not the case. But a man from the hill country of Ephraim, Sheba, the son of Bichri by name, has lifted up his hand against King David. Only hand him over, and I will depart from the city." And the woman said to Joab, "Behold, his head will be thrown to you over the wall." Then the woman wisely came to all the people, and they cut off the head of Sheba the son of Bichri and threw it to Joab. So he blew the trumpet, and they were dispersed from the city, each to his tent. Joab also returned to the king at Jerusalem. So Joab makes the deal. "Just give me the man. I'm not interested in your city. Give me Sheba and we'll be happy." That's what happened. She got somebody to cut his head off and threw the head over the wall. Now, Joab says that Sheba is from the hill country of Ephraim. That hill country of Ephraim, Ephraim's to the north of Benjamin. Sheba was from Benjamin. But that hill country of Ephraim was that spine of mountains that went up and down Israel, and it extended into Benjamin. So the hill country of Ephraim doesn't mean he's from the tribe of Ephraim. Now, Joab tells the wise woman, hey, give me Sheba, and I will depart from the city. Joab knew that once Sheba had been taken care of, the rebellion would totally dissipate, which it did. And so Joab returns to the king at Jerusalem. Now, Joab here has a lot of gall. He's returning to a king whose chief general, Joab, had just killed Amasa. He's killed Amasa, but Joab's not worried. He goes back to Jerusalem. What's he going to say? What's David going to say? Whatever David said, Joab, all he has to do is retort, hey, I just got rid of the rebellion for you. You complaining about Amasa being dead? Well, you got me. What's the problem, David, old boy? David has no choice but to reestablish Joab in his office. And note in all this that Joab's brother Abishai has been totally overshadowed. Joab was the big dog here. He was the military man. We go now to 2 Samuel 20, verses 23 through 26, and we will finish up this audio. Joab commanded the whole army of Israel. Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, was over the Cherethites and Pelethites. Adoram was in charge of forced labor. Jehoshaphat, son of Ahilud, was court historian. Sheva was a court secretary. Zadok and Abiathar were priests. Those are our two old friends, the two co-high priests of Israel. Verse 26, and in addition, Ira the Jerite was David's priest. So David's reign is now being reestablished, and so now the principal officers of that reign are now listed. One little translation issue here, verse 24, Adoram was in charge of forced labor. Most of the translations have that, but King James has tribute. There were two sorts of tribute that a king could take, revenue collected domestically, i.e. a tax, or tribute collected from conquered nations externally, but most of the modern translations have forced labor, so I'm assuming that that's true. When you capture a country outside of Israel, what they would do, what the government would do, was to take the soldiers and put them to work as slaves. Verse 26, Ira the Jerite was David's priest, was a priest of David. Now, David's sons used to hold that office. We look in 2 Samuel 8:18. Jehoiada's son Benaiah was commander of the Cherethites and the Pelethites. No change there. But then, verse 18 says, in 2 Samuel 8, and David's sons were priests. And now it's Ira the Jerite was priest. Well, from that, the pulpit commentary deduces this, quote, the feuds which resulted from David's sin, Bathsheba and Uriah, those feuds had destroyed the concord of the family, the peace of the family, and the usefulness of David's children. In their degradation from this office, we see also a preparation for their being set aside from the succession and the throne given to Solomon. We're going to see that when we get to Kings, but already here is a hint that David's sons have been demoted as priests. And when we talk about priests, by the way, the ark was in a tent in Jerusalem. The tabernacle was still in Gibeon. And there was no temple built yet, of course, either. That doesn't happen until Solomon's time. But they still had priests to do their thing, offer their sacrifices, wherever they may have been offered. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished 2 Samuel chapter 20. We're now ready to go to our next chapter, chapter 21, where we will see David avenging the Gibeonites, and then we will see David making war with the Philistines. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.